Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 7th of July. Whenever you have a billion people all over the world watching the memorial service for Michael Jackson, you figure you got to pay attention to this issue, and we will this hour. The New York Times had an interesting collection of columns, I believe it was yesterday, and one of the authors at the Manhattan Institute said that all of America could love Michael Jackson because he made sure not to be anyone. The surgery, the falsetto speech, and the costumes were someone keeping himself at a distance. We saw a ghost who could sing up a storm and dance better, but so weightlessly in both cases, with the airy voice and always the moonwalking. Others have said much of America and the world honored Jackson as a flawed hero of their or their children's generation. They took all his imperfections, real and imagined, into account and embraced him as a reflection of their own sense of joy and peace and the irrelevance of race and color. Even the instances of alleged sexual abuse of boys and millions of dollars spent out of court settlements wasn't enough to staunch the affection the world at large has for Michael. He represented hope, inspiration, and the celebration of life, however unorthodox in his own life he may have been. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about Michael Jackson, and we have as our guest Professor Tricia Rose. She is a professor of Africana Studies at Brown University, specializing in 20th century African American culture and politics, social history, popular culture, gender, and sexuality. In addition to her role in studying Black cultural production, the role of new technologies and ideologies about race in U.S. life, and the politics of intimacy and social justice, a central facet of her work reflects a very deep interest in examining the current legacies of racial and other forms of structural relations and exploring the creative and visionary strategies developed by artists, communities, and movements to build a more just society. And we're going to welcome phone calls. Our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. It was hard to escape. For those of you who didn't watch all of the coverage, it was hard to escape some coverage because it was covered so remarkably extensively over the last 2 weeks. So we're going to jump into our conversation and welcome your phone calls as we go along. And Professor Rose, thank you very much. Of all the people I saw on television the last couple of weeks, you were the one I said, we got to get her on here because I thought you were very, very insightful. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I appreciate that because there was plenty of commentary. So
there was plenty of commentary, wasn't there? Let me ask you, I'm interested in the work that you're doing on building a more just society, how artists may do that, how communities may do that. Do you think that was part of Michael Jackson's life? Was he out to build a more just society or not?
Well, I think there's little doubt that he saw that as a very important part of his creative vision. It was just too consistent. I mean, of course, early songs that were about sort of, you know, personal love relationships were written by others, but as Michael grew and developed, his repertoire of songs engaged, substantial questions of how we can use human interconnectedness through the arts as a means for creating a just society, not tearing society down, but challenging various societies. And here I don't just mean the United States when I say society. I guess I mean sort of human society to think about these matters. Now, I'm not saying he was a political theorist, right, and that he's up there with the great political thinkers in the world, but it is to say that artists do have a profoundly significant and unique role in helping us see that which we are unable to see, to bring out a kind of creative self, to open us up. I mean, you know, healing music is a very powerful human force. And he was very clear about that. And he knew about that. And he worked toward that. And you feel that spirit in the content of the actual music, but you also hear it in the lyrics over and over again.
Mm-hmm. What was amazing to me, and I need for you to explain this to me more, is this worldwide fascination with him. He was popular all over the world. The memorial service watched in Moscow, in the Philippines, in Japan, in Africa, everywhere in the world. Why was that?
Well, you know, I mean, what's fascinating is that no one's really, I don't think, been able to answer that question seriously enough or successfully enough. It's more the idea of him as a phenomenon overshadows the answer to that question. So you hear a lot of commentary and you even read articles that talk about the phenomenon. Oh, he did this, or this many millions showed up, or this many people fainted, or,
right.
You know, so it sort of becomes a self-explanation. It's not an analysis. And I think the analysis would require a certain kind of connection of history, place, and spirituality that we're not quite well equipped to do, you know, not only in the scholarly world, but even in the spiritual world. I mean, there's this sort of a sacred, secular divide that makes it, I think, very difficult to figure out how to place him. So, I mean, I think just speaking very much off the cuff, because that's a very big question to try to concretely answer it, I think that he had a profound emotional intelligence, and he was able to convey. I mean, there was a way in which he was kind of a medium. I don't know if you caught much of yesterday's memorial stuff.
I did see quite a bit,
Smokey, yeah. So when Smokey Robinson was describing the famous story along with Berry Gordy about the fact that he sang his own song better than him, you know, than he did, and that he was only 10 years old, and what could he know about love and loss? And now some of that may have been that as a child he had trauma, right, and mm-hmm. he was able to attach to it. But I also think some people come into this world with a certain kind of, you know, knowledge, right, that isn't a knowingness, that isn't about your exact experiences. And there's a way in which some people, I think, are mediums in this way. And it's not, I'm not talking about paranormal. I'm just saying I think there's a level of emotional access that some people have that other people do not. And he had that. So that translates around the world without being able to speak the same language. It translates in the body. It translates in the way you communicate. And it reflects back in the people. They see themselves reflected in what he's saying. Because of that. And I think that's one primary thing. The other thing is that, you know, I really do believe that music of the African diaspora is a profoundly embracing approach to music. It's, for the most part, relies on the body in a way that engages people. It is very polyrhythmic and exciting and dynamic, but it's also accessible. And so it's not abstract and cerebral always in a way that keeps people out. You see, mm-hmm. You can appreciate it on many levels. You can appreciate it if you're a scholar and go into all the abstraction about it, but you can also just viscerally appreciate it. And that's true also about Black Christianity in the music and how a certain kind of spiritual force coupled with what I would consider to be a kind of African diasporic life force in the music also brought people together. So it was Michael as an individual and a set of traditions that he reworked so brilliantly that I think partly explains this. I have one more thing for you.
Sure.
Though.
Oh yeah,
hold
go
on.
Ahead.
I know we're on Smart People's Radio, so let me drop one more. Let me drop one more thing for you, which is that the global environment had access to Michael in a way they didn't have access to, say, Jimi Hendrix or say Ella Fitzgerald. Right, the moment that he appears as an adult and comes of age and breaks all of these barriers is the moment of a profound technological explosion,
yes, right.
Where not just recorded music, but video images and extensive expansion of visual television, more and more channels, more and more cable, and eventually the internet, produces a world of representation of artists that gave him a global stage. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just who he was. I mean, had he arrived 100 years ago, he couldn't be who he is. It wouldn't matter how brilliant an artist he was. He just couldn't have that global reach. You see my point. So,
right.
Part of it is about the when, in addition to his personal, spiritual, emotional intelligence and the music that he created. Mm-hmm. I think those are the three main reasons.
You know, what I find most fascinating about him, other than, you know, his character is so riveting, is his dancing. I just think he was a beautiful dancer in this comparison with Fred Astaire, but it's just, I turn the sound down sometimes and just watch him move. There aren't very many people in my life I can remember who moved like that.
No, there is a kind of possession, right? I mean, he's transformed on the stage as into another entity. Everyone says he's this off the stage, right? And he's shy and quiet, and then you get him on the stage, and it's almost like you don't recognize him, right? So he's just a brilliant, brilliant dancer, and I'm really hoping that, you know, dance scholars begin to seriously unpack the complexity, both of what he does as a form, but also the traditions he borrows from and how he remakes them. Because there's so much genius in that that we don't understand. You know, we need translators. That's not just for Michael. I mean, I think that's true for all art. We need people to help us see why this works so beautifully, why it moves us. But you're absolutely right. I mean, he is... I was watching on Palladium, another, you know, cable station of the zillions that I seem to get every day. And it was a live performance of Usher, who was also, as you know, at the memorial service. And he's considered a kind of heir, right? He borrows a lot of Mike's stuff, and he's always been very respectful of it. And I watched his concert, you know, and I used to think, wow, what a great dancer. You know, like, Usher's great. He's holding up the mantle. And he is very talented. But after having seen Michael all day long and realizing that I hadn't really directly compared anybody to him, to Michael, it was not even close. Mm-hmm. It was just so far off the map of possibility that I realized, my gosh, we really fell asleep at the wheel. You know, we didn't really understand what he was doing for us. We got caught up in plastic surgery. We got caught up in all this other stuff, and we lost our way around thinking of this gift in our presence, really, you know, intellectually and spiritually.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about his complexity. This was from somebody at the Manhattan Institute. The Times wrote this thing yesterday about him, and I think it was interesting, and I've heard you speak about the issue of race and maybe hating himself because he was black, maybe his father beating him up and telling him how ugly he was, etc. So put the element of race in this. But I thought this was a fascinating comment. All of America could love Michael Jackson because he made sure not to be anyone. The surgery, the falsetto speech, the costumes were someone keeping himself at a distance. He was so willfully nonspecific that he became a distillation of brilliance, of no race, gender, or age. Just mesmerizing. We could all love him because he made sure not to actually be anyone. It was a fascinating trick, and it sticks with us.
Well, I'm not sure who that was. I was so busy yesterday.
His name is John McWhorter, senior fellow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I know him. I tend to disagree with John, although I appreciate his efforts to speak on these matters. I think that I would read this quite the other way around. It's not that he made sure not to be anything, but that he consistently, Michael Jackson, attempted to unify the force of seeming oppositions. So in the process, you know, so he seemed to unify the seeming oppositions that define what we think are the boundaries of identity. So he was both a growlingly masculine in his voice in certain ways and in his music, a kind of muscular, typical masculinity. But he also, in his voice and in other places, embodied a delicacy that's often associated with femininity, including his falsetto.
Mm-hmm.
He was always rooted in African-American culture and always honored the musical traditions that he loved, out of which he came, and connected to other traditions around the world, as in samba and other musics in Brazil and West African music, et cetera, et cetera. But he also did not limit himself to a kind of black identity. Now, his color change, which again is another matter, all very complicated, that we have to figure out how to deal with. But I think that his skin color and the way he dealt with that with the plastic surgery suggested that sort of blackness and whiteness was something that he felt you could move across. And we can talk more about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But the same thing was true with his obsession with, you know, connecting to the world as an American. He knew he was an American. He always said he was an African American. He never said he wasn't. Much of his extraordinary philanthropy was racially specific in that he understood there was a history of racial inequality that he felt he could help limit in the future. But he connected to third world nations very consciously and in a sustained way. He was very comfortable with the level of glitz. He pursued it. He had issues with, I think, consumption, right, as many of us do. We see the crisis we're in now in the United States as well as that. But he also maintained a kind of core humanity and a focus on a common good that goes against market values. These are profound oppositions in our society that he worked across. Now, that's not the equivalent to me of making sure you're nothing. You see, I mean, he had a distinctive style consistently over the past, you know, 30 years. I mean, he was unmistakably Michael Jackson. So it wasn't that he was just any old thing all the time. So I would really beg to differ with that. Although I think that Michael confuses us, right? Because unless we're willing to pay really close attention to the traditions out of which he comes and his efforts to connect us through that, then we're not going to be able to see him properly. We're going to mistake him for kind of a chameleon.
So what does the skin change say about race? Did it say that whiteness was his standard of beauty, that it is still the standard of beauty?
Well, you know, this is like the heart of, I call this issue, and it's not just with MJ, but I call this issue America's racial Rorschach test. And I'm sure your listeners recall this psychological test, which was also called the ink blot study, where people would be given various ink blots that had no particular, they would have different forms. It'd be like if you drop an ink blot and cover paper over it, right, and just see what pattern it makes. And people would tell you what they thought was going on. Oh, that's two people arguing, or that's a tree in the woods. And so basically by looking at the ink blot, you talk about yourself. And I really think that what we make of Michael Jackson really tells us more about us than about him. So the range of responses about this have been he was self-hating, he hated himself, he wasn't a man anymore, he loved whites, he was just a freak, he was obsessed with changing his origins, you know, all of that.
Right.
You know, so depending on, or it made him universal, right, or, you know, some people have said they didn't even know, especially younger fans, didn't even know he was quote-unquote black, which is kind of interesting as a way of responding
yes,
to
it. Yes, it is.
So all of this says as much about us or more than it does about Michael. But here's what I'm really hoping we get to. I'm hoping we get to the point where we know that the man had vitiligo, a skin pigment-losing illness,
mm-hmm.
an autoimmune illness. If some autopsy could please put this in writing, you know, it would make my life a lot easier. Because, look, if the man has vitiligo and he's basically turning white, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
or at least pale, whatever we want to call that, then he has to grapple with what his features look like on very fair skin and the disjuncture that would cause. And we think about now how, let's say, black albinos might look like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then we add that dimension, to that dimension, we add the media obsession with European features in entertainment. I mean, pretty much everyone's having plastic surgery in Hollywood. Much of his family had plastic surgery, which I find really interesting. They all look alike, relatively, with Michael being the most extreme, but it's all plastic surgery. If you look at the early pictures, you know, it looks like they've all been to the same doctor. So then the question is, how come no one asks that question? Why is it always only Michael that gets this level of critique? So now he changes his features. Then it seems clear he turns a point where he goes way too far, and it seems like an illness where he's just shaving his face, right, beyond
yes.
repair. And then you have to add the dimension of, okay, what's his self-image about? What's his some potential self-hatred about that could be about his father, that could be about
right.
American society? It could be about wanting to change himself all the time, to be fresh, to be afraid, to not be on top, insecurity. All of those things could be part of it. But then you have to ask this much harder question, which is, if Michael Jackson had not made the moves he made and not been such a visual chameleon, in other words, if he had just let himself be medically what he would have been, would he have been able to transcend so many racial boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
Was his sort of manipulation of whiteness in the way that he did, was it a vehicle for other people to really stay attached to him?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, and of course, we don't know the answer to that. But I think it's important to throw it around the other way and not just to assume that this was just a personal illness and nothing else. Everything else would have been the same if
right.
he had left himself basically unchanged. So, I mean, I think there's just a lot to unpack there. And
yep.
a lot of it hinges on the vitiligo for me. Right. I mean, if the man's bleaching his skin, which I find hard, I don't even know if you can technically do that. I mean, he clearly looked like he had consistently pale skin by the end of his life. Being under umbrellas. A lot of his behaviors are what vitiligo patients do to keep the sun away. It's very, very frail skin that burns very easily.
Right.
So you know what I mean? That's really the thing. We don't know that, and so we don't have a way to put these pieces together in a way that makes sense. And so we assume this crazy racial version.
Right. Let's talk about the child abuse for a moment, and then we're going to go to phone calls because we have many of them. Bob Herbert had a particularly scathing column, really, which I'm sure you saw a couple days ago. And I like Bob Herbert. You know, I respect him. I like to listen to his political judgments. He talks about, behind the Jackson facade, the horror of child abuse. Court records and reams of well-documented media accounts contain a stream of serious allegations of child sex abuse and other inappropriate behavior with very young boys. He talks about the case of alleged pedophilia where he says the details of which would make your hair stand on end was settled for a reported $25 million. And, of course, we know about more about the other case, which he was acquitted of all charges there. What do you make of all of this? This is, to a lot of people, this is extremely disturbing, and it diminishes his stature significantly.
Well, I can understand that, and I think that it's totally understandable that people would, when they get to a place of kind of, you know, idolatry, right, they mm-hmm. get very upset if they feel that someone who they've given this status to appears to be so out of sync and appears to be a predator of sorts, right?
Right.
That I completely understand. I have a couple of problems with the way this is playing out in the media. Number one, I'm growing concerned in general in American society that, you know, the court system and its credibility is declining so rapidly that we don't actually pay attention to verdicts. We kind of just decide what has happened based on what we think is complete evidence, and then we just move on with our opinion, untouched by what's happened, by the verdict. And I'm not suggesting that there have not been miscarriages of justice all along, but I am getting a little bit concerned that we're just unwilling to acknowledge that what we want to believe may not be true, right? What seems logical simply to us may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what details he's talking about, and they would have to be clearly substantiated. And, you know, again, that's what the court is for. I'm not a lawyer, and I wasn't sitting in these trials, and so I can't say. I may very well have been appalled myself. But I think the kind of casual reassertion of that, when, for example, a number of victims, I understand from some websites, I don't know how credible they are, but they claim that some of these victims have recanted. Now, again, I'd have to do all this research to find out where the truth is, and it's just not where I'm interested in spending my time right now. But I think, again, it's the Rorschach test question. What is our obsession here, right? We have a Catholic Church that has paid quietly hundreds of millions of dollars to protect its priests for institutionalized pedophilia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we idolize that institution, and we continue to idolize that institution, right? So it's not like that's not something we're comfortable doing. And we have there hundreds of priests. This isn't one or two.
Right.
It's an institutional crisis.
Right.
And yet we don't seem to be willing to provide that same level of scathing criticism and rejection that seems to happen when we approach a figure like a Michael Jackson who is being accused of these things and, in fact, has been acquitted, right? And in some cases stayed out of court because there's nothing to be gained there. He's going to pay it anyway. So I guess I'm more interested in that part of it. Of course, if there are children who were abused by him, I'm very saddened by that. I'm angered by that. And he should have paid for that properly, whatever that would be.
So but you're not sure we know the truth here.
I'm assuming that if he was acquitted, that's why I started with the legal justice system, right? What is our relationship to the justice system? Are we saying that because he's rich, we can't get any justice? If we're saying that, then we have a much more systemic problem that we should really be addressing, and we can't be strategic about that. We can't say it's just in this case where we don't like the verdict, but over here where we like the verdict, we have nothing to say. So that's my first point about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm saying, since he was acquitted, then I say, well, what can I do about that? I think, you know, that is what it is. Some have recanted.
Mm-hmm.
Famous people are often victimized by predatory families.
Mm-hmm.
That's a possibility here, especially given his strangeness, right? I mean, I'll admit the man is not a regular person. but we know that. It's like not new information. But on one last thing I'd like to say is, remember the 1980s? I was thinking about this yesterday when the child kid daycare thing, there were supposedly a roving band of adults sexually abusing children, and everything seemed completely true and logical for months, years. And when the whole thing fell apart, where was everybody? When these people's lives were completely destroyed by a feeding frenzy of misinformation, where was everybody? So, I mean, I just want us to protect children and protect society's process at the same time.
Let's pause for a moment to return and welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour as we talk about Michael Jackson is Tricia Rose, professor and chair of the Department of Africana Studies at Brown University, author of Black Noise, Rap Music, and Black Culture in Contemporary America, and most recently, The Hip Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip Hop and Why It Matters. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Care to send an email? You could do that. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we talk with the young author of 6 Months in Sudan, A Young Doctor in a War-Torn Village. The book started as a series of blogs that this doctor wrote about encountering just all kinds of disease, war. It's a beautifully written book and stays with you. And for him, the experience certainly has stayed with him. All right, let's go to phone calls for Tricia Rose. We start with Paul from La Crosse. Hello, Paul.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think one thing that I noticed this time was that nobody had a Queen Elizabeth moment. That when Princess Di was killed in that car accident, the Queen came out with a very proper and extremely flat-footed response to her former daughter-in-law's death. And she was just crucified for it. And people were saying, well, this could be the end of the monarchy because the Queen is so bad. And she spent the next week backpedaling and offering condolences and things like this, trying to get past it. This time, the media, all the people, the social people, until, of course, Congressman King put his foot in his mouth, but everybody sort of said, this is for the fans. You know, Michael Jackson died. I may not get it, but I'm not going to tell them, you know, how they're supposed to mourn, how they're supposed to grieve, or how this is supposed to take place. And everyone just sort of stepped back and said, we're going to, we're going to let this just happen. And we're going to do the right thing by Michael Jackson and his fans, and not say, well, you know, they should have done this or they should have. We're not going to nitpick this. We're just going to let it go. And I think because of that, everybody was able to be, for the fans, they were able to be very natural about it, and there was no reason for them to push back against anybody because nobody was attacking him.
Hmm. Professor Rose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really insightful way of thinking about it. I mean, there was a little bit of pushback, but I think for the most part, people, I agree with you, that they said, let's give him this day because, I mean, we're looking at, tens of millions of people around the world, and there's just something about that power that is hard to deny, although not impossible. We've denied it, but it is hard to deny, and I think it's important to let people heal over it. I mean, it is, it's a loss. It really isn't just about Michael. It's about, at his best, he embodied things that we adore and that we value as human beings, at his best. Again, I'm being specific. I'm not saying everything about him. And few people articulated that so powerfully for so long. And so I think you're right. People did step away. Now, there'll be the continued hysteria over all the other elements, probably for the next, 15 years. So I'm grateful for the respite myself. I think that's a really, really nice point.
Thanks, Paul, for the call. Terry is next from Menasha. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I have been listening to the radio yesterday evening and this morning. And when I first heard some of the discussion about the Jackson funeral and the size of it and everything, I wasn't at all interested. And I was kind of surprised that it was going to be so covered on NPR and on my public radio stations, and I have been so surprised at how much I'm learning. I mean, I had kind of written him off because of his strangeness it pushed me away. I wasn't attracted to his music because I didn't understand him, and he made me uncomfortable.
Hmm.
And I am just feeling like the radio is really doing, the public radio, is, you guys are doing a big service because you are presenting me with something that I wasn't expecting, and that is important. And I'm really getting a lot out of this discussion, especially Professor Rose. Is it Rose?
Yes.
Yes.
Especially what you said about how we view the justice system. I just really find what you said profound, and I wanted to thank you, Kathleen. I think this is a really excellent show.
Thanks, Terry, for the call.
Okay, bye.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I totally concur. Not about me and my being wonderful, but about the previous point that she's so right about. I mean, to be honest, I fell asleep on Michael Jackson. I mean, I'm trained to think about culture, race, gender, blah, blah, blah. That's my job. And I fell asleep at the wheel in the early 90s, right? Oh, Mike's over. You know, he's a psycho. He's a weirdo. Look what fame did to him. You know, look what his father did. You know, like, I just gave this very knee-jerk. Now, I didn't go around publicly assaulting him, but I just kind of forgot about him. And, you know, I'm ashamed to say that the impact of our national focus and what we don't talk about, what lack of cultural depth we allow to happen, can make us miss some of the most extraordinary contributions that people make. And we lose sight of what their gifts might be, which only contributes to the suffering that, not only of his personal suffering, but our own collective loss of our way. So I really agree, and I felt weirded out too. And again, I didn't know what to make of it, right? I mean, but it's true. And there's something tragic when you look at the coverage and the lack of knowledge that people just don't know anything about the music that he makes, or that. We just, whoever sells a lot of records, that's who we talk about, you know? Imagine if he didn't sell a lot of records, right? We would never know. We wouldn't even be able to appreciate his art. This is a tragedy. It's a tragedy. So I really appreciate that. That's a really, really good point.
Thanks, Terry, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Professor Tricia Rose, professor and chair, Department of Africana Studies at Brown University, is our guest this hour as we talk about Michael Jackson. That's what's going on. Can you talk a little bit more about the tragedy of his life? You know, the thing that we talked about in the office a lot yesterday is what a life it must be to be this huge star when you're a little kid. Your father's trying to mold this group. People are always trying to make a lot of money off of you. And I mean, I think that would be a fascinating story to follow, too, who benefited from Michael Jackson. But to never have a life. I mean, to never have a life other than being a performer, and then to have this really bad relationship with your dad. It wasn't all the best, was it?
Well, certainly from what I've been able to glean, which is most of what I think your listeners might see, you know, so I don't have any inside track here, but it seemed like a pretty a childhood of great pain and great exhilaration, you know, great extreme mm-hmm. as a childhood. But, you know, I like to, so yes, there's no question that it strikes me that it wasn't just that he had stage parents, right, but that there seemed to be a kind of meanness in his father and an abusiveness that he and his sensitivity, vulnerability, and his importance in the family, right, I mean, he frankly was the meal ticket, probably put him at a certain kind of emotional risk, if not physical risk. So there's no doubt I think he had quite a difficult childhood. Now, he partly benefited from some of the stage parenting, right, because a lot of that discipline and hard work he claims he got from that. But, of course, we'd like to think you could impart that to your children without terrorizing them. But I also think, you know, it's really important to situate him inside of a kind of historical moment for African Americans where we move to big cities on this dream of the promised land of new jobs and wages that are higher than sharecropping and other non-unionized and exploitative industries in the South, where Jim Crow politics made crushing poverty, racial poverty, almost a given, no matter your talent. And this, his father, his mother, his aunts and uncles and the larger community of Gary in Detroit, and Chicago, and Cleveland, and New York, and Baltimore. I mean, all of these urban black communities come for this dream of this possibility, and they make huge sacrifices of separation from families in the South to create this new life. And in many ways, Michael Jackson's family was kind of an industrial uplift story, right?
Yeah,
it was like
sure.
take that moment and turn it into something extraordinary with both sets of talents, right?
Mm-hmm.
Using your hand labor, your hard labor, and your creative gifts. And of course, that's what Motown was all about as a style. Take the industrial model of production on the industry line of, say, making cars and make records
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. You know, so there's this real connection to a historical moment that I think Michael Jackson's death also signifies a death of. And that's one of the reasons so many African Americans across generations love him, because it's not just him, it's also what his whole family stood for, what their relationship was to that moment of African American sense of possibility.
Hmm. Interesting. Do you consider him to be, I was a big fan of Supremes, Temptations, et cetera, and listened a lot to the Jackson 5 because I'm old enough to have done that.
Me too.
Yeah. But the thing is that I don't think of him, I guess, as this major crossover artist, but I guess he was, that he really entered the world of white music. I thought other black artists had done that prior to Michael Jackson.
Yeah, you know, that's so interesting because I didn't think of him that way either. But the vast majority of mainstream Americans who were not following sort of soul and R&B in a focused way, and again, that wouldn't be Detroit, right, or places where there's large black populations,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, pretty much in many other places, they were not getting a steady diet of, you know, Curtis Mayfield and Isaac Hayes. You know, that wasn't like part of their normal musical palette.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In that context, those are the ones who I feel talk about Thriller and Bad, right, the big crossover songs in particular. But Michael, to me, I mean, I was 8 years old. I mean, I don't really remember a time without Michael Jackson, to be really personally honest. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there really isn't much of a time in my life where I remember being a child or an adult in any way without him making music. I mean, I'm a few years younger than he is, not that many. And, you know, when I was 8 years old, we moved to this new housing development, and I had the duel of, you know, Donny Osmond and Michael Jackson, and then, you know, both of their posters up in my room, and Michael won. Eventually, you know, I bought all their singles with my little 25-cent savings. I had all their 45s, and I decided Michael won, so then he got all the poster space, and I would dance like him with my hairbrush and, you know, watch every, you know, then there was the cartoon. I mean, you know, it was just, then I went to college, and then, you know, that was when his adult career started. Then I went to grad school, and he was doing Pretty Young Thing, and, you know, I'm sorry, The Way You Make Me Feel, and, you know, then when I met my husband. It's like my whole life trajectory is like every Michael Jackson album. There's an album for what happened. And that relationship to him is not the same thing as I've entered into a moment of Michael Jackson when he's crossed into my consciousness. You see,
right,
that's a very different relationship to him. And I think those are the people who are more susceptible to a kind of freak show media portrait of him, when you don't see the trajectory of what he was doing and saying and feeling. I mean, I remember when he did Ben, and, you know, he made me feel like a mouse or a rat was like a pet. You know, just the intensity of his capacity to be an empath about a rat. I mean, I know it's corny in one way, but it's also extraordinary in another way, right? You know,
yeah.
Who could do that?
Yeah. Catherine from Madison, hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have to say, first, I feel a little sheepish joining in this conversation because I was noting the irony of the fact that this is the second hour that NPR is devoted to the question of why is everybody making such a fuss about Michael Jackson? But anyway, here I am. I have often speculated, and I was very interested in Dr. Rose's comment about his skin disease. I had not heard that before. There's a lot of psychological kind of speculation about his surgeries and the change in his imagery and so forth. And I haven't heard anyone float the idea that he may have had body dysmorphic disorder, which is a disorder in the OCD spectrum, and he did have a lot of that. So I guess I just wanted to toss that out there. That would make it a little bit less psychological and a little bit more kind of biological.
And what is that? What is that, Catherine?
Pardon?
What is the disorder? What
body dysmorphic disorder?
Uh huh.
And it's kind of like kind of like having anorexia. You look in the mirror and you see something different from what other people see.
Okay.
And you can't get past that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's considered kind of in the obsessive-compulsive spectrum.
Mm.
So it's got a lot of it's very biologically driven.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never heard anybody speculate about that, but to me that seemed like a very likely possibility, a very likely explanation for why he kept going beyond the point at which, you know,
right.
it made sense to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's a funny way that we respond to people with so much fame and so much money and what we think is social power that they have, because their foibles, their vulnerabilities, their flaws seem almost impossible to us, right? Well, why couldn't he fix that problem, right? He's Michael Jackson. There must be someone. But I think it's ironically true that it's people in those positions who have the least access to the kind of self-reflective and community concern, because they can buy people to tell them what their illness tells them they want to see. So, I think it's very possible that that's part of his, you know, his set of conditions. I mean, there's no doubt I think he had some of those issues. I don't think he was just this wily guy who manufactured everything. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense from what I see. He certainly manufactured quite a bit, but I think he lost his way, and that might have been one of his illnesses, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Michael Jackson, our topic this hour on the Ideas Network. 800-486-8655, the number. Kate from Milwaukee. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I wanted to ask a guest. I don't know if she watched any of the ceremonies yesterday. I caught some of this morning, and they were playing the part with Reverend Sharpton making a comment about the problem wasn't with his father, but what his father had to put up with. And I thought, well, what does that mean, given the rumors of him beating Michael and abusing the other kids to a certain extent? Unless it meant that he had to deal with putting those kids to work, because I don't think he was very educated himself. So
right.
He wanted them to work for him and bring in the money, or what?
Well, I think that the clip today might have misled you a little bit. What he was talking to Michael Jackson's children, and he said, "Is nothing strange about your daddy?" Meaning, nothing strange about Michael Jackson. It was strange what he had to deal with. Is that the quote?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't targeted at Joe Jackson. It wasn't that he was talking to Michael about Joe Jackson. He was talking to Michael Jackson's children about Michael Jackson, which is to say that, you know, the media has constructed your dad as a strange, weirdo guy who's just sort of individually eccentric and unexplainable. But Sharpton wanted to use that conversation with the children to say, look, the situation your father had to deal with, which is so complicated and across his whole life, is what was insane, right? The kind of feeding frenzy, the media responses, the fact that he could go nowhere without a mask and a costume on, without being literally overrun. I mean, he probably would have been stampeded. This was really not like a matter of just a little bit of fame. His childhood, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what that quote was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Does that explain it? Did I understand you properly?
Oh, yes. That's what I was confused about. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It was a little confusing today.
Thanks very much for the call. What about his daughter appearing at the end and sobbing and sort of stopping the service in a way with that heartfelt emotion? What did you think of that?
Wow. Well, I've had as an academic, I'm really not supposed to comment till I've digested things. It's sort of a code, code of honor. But here's my partially undigested thought. The first thing I thought was the very first thing was, oh, that's horrible. You know, that emotional response that everyone played up in the media. Just you feel so bad, you know, when any child losing a parent, particularly
yes.
in a situation like that where they had to have had a very interior world. And they had a network, but not the kind of network regular people would have.
Right.
So you feel your heart goes out to her. She's adorable. She's beautiful. All that. Blah blah blah. But then I had this feeling of like how many times I watched that footage yesterday be repeated visually and narratively,
mm-hmm.
and I all of a sudden thought, no wonder he put masks on these children. Right. There, she is now the most recognizable child on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Right, without a mask, and the potential that people will begin to fawn over her and connect to her in this bizarre way that could create the kind of distortions that Michael knew he was a victim of.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, it actually all of a sudden it makes a little sense, right? I mean, so that's my sort of semi-undigested response to that, which is, let's watch this. What's the frenzy about this? Of course a child says this about her daddy. What did you think she was going to say? I mean, what did we think was going on? I mean, were we really that phantasmagorical in our minds about him that we didn't imagine that the man had play dates at all or that he spoke to people in a normal way? I mean, it's just astonishing. It really, again, it's a Rorschach test. It's more about what we are doing. And it actually made him make more sense to me, honestly.
Hmm. Judy from Waukesha. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Judy.
I wanted to just say a few things. My grandchildren just lost their mother, and they live with me now. And the sorrow and the grief is really very hard on them. And so I hope that they get to stay with their grandmother. I'm teaching them, and I'm exposing them to all of Michael Jackson's music, and they love him. And I think that for Michael Jackson, the abuse and the discipline he had to go through, that he came to children and animals because they gave him peace, acceptance and unconditional love that he did not have in his life. Mm-hmm. And that explains Neverland, I think. And my granddaughter, who's 10, came up with the observation that when he was young, he had to live as an adult and had no time for play. And then later, when he was older, he could privately become a child and have the animals and children around him who were very safe. I think the others took advantage of him because of his money and success, and gradually because of his trust, because he was very naive, I think, he was taken down. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a credible narrative, you know, and I think he was as many artistic geniuses are, he was kind of overdeveloped in some ways and underdeveloped in others. Some of it, as you said, about never having been able to be a child. I mean, to be 5 years old and to basically be a superstar by the time you're 8, I mean, I can't imagine it. But, you know, also people who are incredibly talented in one thing, it's very hard to develop a certain kind of maturity in other areas. And so that may very well have been one of his Achilles heels. I mean, I really do. I hope things work out in your family and that... that anyone can be the right kind of inspiration, but hopefully those who've experienced it, you know, can lead the way.
It's interesting that some of his, I don't know about his friendships or how close they were, but the people he seemed to pal around with were also child stars, right?
Yeah.
Elizabeth Taylor and Brooke Shields, and I don't know if they talked about being child stars or what, but they were among his closest friends, I guess.
Yeah, I think they, in fact, it seemed most of his celebrity friends were, in fact, former child stars. I think he really tapped into that experience. And I think that is a unique set of experiences.
Right.
That is tragic. I mean, someone recently did an article looking at how many child stars don't make it and who really just get completely lost with drugs and, you know, other problems and sort of can't construct an adult life. And under those circumstances, and they weren't nearly as famous as Michael Jackson, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact, and they weren't black, right? I mean, and this is not irrelevant. I mean, he's his individual fame and issues, I mean, he also had racial hurdles. I mean, the industry is notoriously, historically, racially discriminatory in terms of contracts and behavior and resources. He transcended a lot of that, but he still had to grapple with those institutions. And then there's, of course, what it means to try to be a black superstar in the 1970s and 80s, right, in a nation
right.
that really has none. So, you know, I mean, that on top of being a child star, I mean, it's actually a miracle he was as vaguely sane as he seems to have been. And I say vaguely because I don't know him, but I know there's a lot of challenges to that. But you know, he seems to me he could have killed himself a long time ago, and I wouldn't have been surprised.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. All right, let's take one more phone call. Jim from Oshkosh. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. The last lady stole my thunder, and your guest as well, but I'll piggyback on their comments that it's kind of common, it seems like, that children who become such stars that do not have a childhood like a normal childhood run into all these problems. And I think the lady before me said it very well, that Neverland became a substitute for a childhood he never had. And Brooke Shields' comment that she had such fun with Michael because when they got together, they acted like children, was a very telling comment. And I think that his, most of his adult life was spent in trying to resurrect the childhood that he never had. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. Professor Rose, thank you so much for being with us. You were indeed the right person for this discussion, and I'm glad to have met you and hope we talk again.
Oh, it's my pleasure entirely, and you have a wonderful audience and a great show, and I'm glad to be able to participate.
Thank you. We'll invite you again. Professor Tricia Rose, professor and chair of the Department of Africana Studies at Brown University, author of Black Noise, Rap Music and Black Culture in Contemporary America, and most recently, The Hip-Hop Wars, What We Talk About When We Talk About Hip-Hop and Why It Matters. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls, everybody.